Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 21 of Magic FM. I'm Gabby Sparks, one of your hosts today, and I'm joined today by Mashi, as always, and Luis, special guest, somewhat special guest today.
We said it right the first time.
I think we could just say guest at this point, can't we?
Guest of the podcast today. Anyway, fellas, yeah. How are you doing? It's really good to check in on you.
Well, we live together, so you kind of know how I'm
doing. Luis, you know, you can just zip it.
This is why we don't ask Gabby how she's doing, because that's the whole podcast complaining about Luis. So
yeah. How about this, Mashi? I care to know how you're doing. How are you doing?
Well, thank you, Gabby. It's been interesting. You know, obviously there's a pandemic and it's changed a lot. I've learned a lot of lessons about being American in the sense of it's actually newsworthy and noteworthy to go to a grocery store and not just see like – it's one thing when you see one item out on a shelf or even like, oh, wow, this item is popular. The shelf isn't fully stocked. As an American, I'm so used to seeing every shelf in the grocery store constantly full.
Yeah.
And going to a grocery store and seeing not just a shelf, but shelves wiped out is just like bizarre to me. It's been a new experience. I'm grateful for the plenty I'm used to living in. I certainly took it for granted. So I'm
yeah,
it
certainly
that,
makes but... you think about that, right? About how
oh my gosh,
how used we are so used to seeing that for sure. So for this podcast today, I did want to level set expectations with everybody listening. We didn't really want to go super deep into what it's like living in a pandemic right now. What we wanted to do is do something a little bit more lighthearted and more fun. Just to kind of, I don't know, you get to hang out with us and have a welcome distraction in a world where every piece of news that we get is like bad news, yeah, right? So
for the rest of this podcast, the next hour or whatever, this is going to be a corona-free zone, especially I didn't bring a beer. So, you know, in every sense, a corona-free zone. So.
Yeah, so we just want you to be able to like relax and hang out with us and not worry too much about the current state of affairs, because it's obviously not good. Before we actually go any deeper into it, I did want to do a shout out, not for the sponsor of the podcast today, but actually wanted to do something a little bit different. We wanted to shout out all the content creators and people out there that it would be good to support right now, because it's obviously a very unstable economic time for a lot of people. But with all the Grand Prix canceled, there's been a lot of people in the Magic community right now where a lot of the content creators have like side hustles and contracts and things that they do at Grand Prix, events that they fly to, things that they do on the side. And everything's basically up in the air for this. So we've already started to see a little bit of this with some other content creators asking, you know, hey, if this is a really good month for you to sub to our Patreon, if you can spare it and things like that. So we just wanted to do a big shout out for all the content creators out there. Everyone in Team CFB is another good example of people who are in the same situation. So if you can, and even if it's just like saying that you appreciate that the work they do, like that's pretty meaningful.
Yeah, I kind of went into this on my stream 2 days ago, where a lot of folks, you know, they think like, wow, now's a great time to be a content creator because everyone's at home consuming content. And that part is true. But like Gabby said, every content creator we know, every streamer we know has a bunch of side hustles and other projects. And because the fact of the matter is you can't just have one income stream as a content creator, because that just does not how the economics work. So you'll have folks who have a stream, but also we're relying on income from going to 6 Magic Fests and doing coverage there, or doing, you know, whatever it is, like appearances or working with sponsors who have, a lot of sponsors have temporarily paused their campaigns because they're just unable to fulfill. So if you have the bandwidth to help, now is a great time to support the folks who are going to keep you entertained throughout this time. So you got to watch out for yourself. But if you're someone who's in a position to give, you know, there's a lot of folks like Riley Knight. You know, he does great content. Team CFB, yeah. Megan and Maria from Good Luck High Five.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, they're great. Marshall, don't forget Marshall.
Yeah,
yeah, no, he's fine. He's, that's
right. I think the other thing to remember is a lot of people have side hustles that are outside of Magic that are still impacted by this. Mm-hmm. If they're serving, right. You know, because dining rooms across the country are closed. And I mean,
yeah, I mean, my younger brother, you know, the restaurant he manages is just shut down. So
yeah, so I mean, it's obviously we view things, and this is a Magic based podcast, and we make this for, you know, our Magic community, but this is everywhere, and everyone's impacted. So I, as you've already said, Luis, for a lot of people, streaming and content creation is a side hustle. And so really showing that gratitude. And I want to echo another thing you said, which is just kind words and support can mean a lot in a time like this. There's a huge opportunity here for streamers, yes, to stream and maybe develop an audience, but that audience may not have a lot of disposable income too. And so showing that gratitude for the entertainment that I think we all want. I mean, I'm probably gonna be watching more streams in the next few weeks than I ever have. I think is really important.
All right, So now we're gonna enter our corona-free hour. We made it past,
and now
let's get to some questions.
Yeah, so we got a lot of questions. It was awesome. Thank you, everybody who submitted questions. You could have found them either on Mashi's, Luis's, or my Twitter. We all tweeted it. But we did ask that people can ask us anything, not just Magic related. So we are going to go into some not Magic questions at some point here in the middle. All right, so let's get to it. The first person asked, this was Aberdasher, what can I do with all these Dominaria boxes that I'm, now that I'm socially isolating and I have no friends to draft with? Is cracking them for no value the only option?
I think one of the things I've seen is if you find someone, and I mean, it doesn't have to be the same set. You can always find someone somewhere who has six packs of Magic maybe that they don't have open, and build sealed pools and play remotely. That's the first thing that came to my mind. I'm not averse to cracking packs for no value, but that's just my take on it.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Luis?
Well, I was going to say one suggestion I've seen people do is you can play Booster Blitz. You can do that pretty easily over like a webcam. And so how that works is you'll open your pack and you'll make either four or five piles. You can do whichever one you decided to with your opponent. And these piles are of three cards each. You have infinite mana and everyone starts at five life. And so you have to, like, every pile has to have like a way to win, a way to maybe stop them from winning. Mm-hmm. You know, discard's really good if you're on the play. Like, and you can do that across sets, even though it's good in the same set, but it's also fine across sets too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
it's,
it can be pretty
so
fun.
Much fun. I learned about this game at some point doing coverage one of the weekends, and because it's a way that you can actually play Magic in an interesting way that has like no setup required, basically, because you don't have to worry about lands, you don't have to like deck build, nothing like that. You just do have to think about which three cards do I want to put in this pile. Like sometimes you might put like a dead card, a bomb card, and like a counter spell, because there's just going to be some cards that you can't use. So putting like the land in there, or putting like the unplayable equipment can be good when you're like pairing it with two other really good cards. So yeah, Booster Blitz is really, really fun. I love that game.
It's awesome. I think Wedge taught me Booster Blitz in at a GP Toronto a year or two ago. And it's awesome. It's the best way to kind of crack packs, I think. But if you actually want to play with them, you can. You can find ways to do it. Booster Blitz, sealed, any
cracking
any
packs is great. I think it's fine.
I love it.
Yeah,
I love it.
I did too. Our next question is actually on the topic of cracking packs.
Cracking packs.
Yeah. So Lady Atarka asked, I have a question. Thoughts on cracking packs for no value, quote unquote. And is it actually value to tilt friends by cracking said packs?
I mean, it certainly can be, because there are people who get bothered by packs getting cracked, because it's like you could draft with those packs. But the way I see it, this is kind of how I see the cards I play with too, because if you guys have ever watched me play, I'm very particular with which cards I play with. You know, I make sure I have all matching lands, and I like using fancy basics, and I like using beta cards, and on stream with people like, oh, what do you think about your opponent using mismatched white border lands? And what I'll always say is, I don't care what my opponent does. They get to play whatever what they want, and I'll play with whatever I want. I like my lands to look a certain way. I would never like bag on someone for them doing the same or not doing the same thing. Cracking packs is like that, where I don't randomly crack packs because I would rather draft with them, but I never would have a problem with someone else doing that. You get to do what you want with your own stuff.
There is so much value, I think, if your friends really have an issue with it, to value cracking packs, by the way. The second part of the question is like, is there value there? Yes.
Yeah.
Lady Atarka. There is 100% value there. That being said, I think cracking packs is fun. Gabby, you talked about Booster Blitz, and yeah, that's a great way to crack packs if you have someone to play with. Just you're essentially cracking packs, but you're still getting that gameplay value.
You're getting some fun out of it for sure. So it's funny. Lady Atarka is a friend of my stream, and she knows Marshall really dislikes people cracking packs. So at a Grand Prix, she walked behind coverage with just some packs to crack when Marshall was on air and just like cracked them in the background. That's all she did. And then left. So there's actually a coverage clip at some point of her doing this in the background while Marshall was not watching, not really, because he was commentating the game. But people knew about it. It was really, really funny.
See, and that's value. How much, how much value is that, right?
Yeah, like,
that's
a ton of value. We've been talking about the story. This was like a GP Vegas 2 years ago or something. It was a long time ago.
So, yes, I think there is, if you enjoy, you know, as Luis is pointing out, however you want to interact with Magic that you enjoy, there's value in that, but there's certainly value in tilting others in a good-natured way.
Definitely. German Gary Oak asks, what's the best thing an opponent did during a game? What makes somebody a great opponent other than Magic specific skills? So you might want to think about this one. Luis had an answer immediately.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I love playing against Shota Yasuoka, he's in the Hall of Fame, excellent Magic player, played against him in a ton of situations, including like a Pro Tour top eight. And he's known for playing really fast. He's a Pro Tour champion. You know, he plays super fast. I think he's the person who plays fastest on the PT, and I think I'm second. Wow. And one of the things I love about playing against him is we both give the other the benefit of the doubt. We're like, when he has a 5-5 and I have a 2-2 and I'm at five, he'll just immediately attack and assume I'm going to throw my creature away and say go. Like if I've got something, he'll just basically, we'll both just kind of play assuming the opponent's going to make the right play. I really like it because I feel like it's a pretty good sign of respect from both players. He doesn't assume I'm going to miss something. I don't assume he's going to miss something. We just kind of take these actions really quickly. And coverage in the top eight of PT SOI Shadows, they asked us to play slower, which has never happened in the history of coverage because everyone plays so goddamn slow. So, but they asked us, hey, can you guys slow down a little? Because like I remember once I was playing the Black Green Aristocrat.
They asked you to do that going into the top eight, like, because you guys played a bunch. I remember I was doing coverage of that event, and you played in the Swiss like once or twice, I think. So it was going too fast. So leading into the top eight, you had a players meeting, and part of the players meeting was also, can you please slow down?
I had a Zulaport Cutthroat in play, which drains your opponent for one every time you lose a creature. And I had the Abbey that turns into Ormondal, the 9/7, land. Mm-hmm. And once I played the Cutthroat, he just scooped up all his cards because he knew I was going to sack five things to the Abbey and kill him. And coverage was like, what happened? How did that game even end? Because when we both knew what was going on. I love playing on Shota for that reason.
I think a huge note here is, I think that's great, but you got to have a relationship with the person you're playing if you're going to play that way. Please don't show up and say, well, Luis said this is a great way to play Magic. No. And this I'm going to play unique. Magic this way.
He's the only person I play Magic with that where this happens. Like, even other people I know we're a lot slower and we also like confirm everything, but with Shota, he just plays like that. And I love it. I'm totally into it.
Let's see. I had an experience at a Grand Prix. It was actually in the feature match area as a joke. Ricky Hayashi put all the CFB events team, not team CFB, like Lems, myself, Sasso. Like, we were all at this event, Minneapolis, I think it was, playing. And so he put all of us in the feature match area, and I was playing against an opponent. And I cannot remember. I can picture the card. It's a Simic legend. And it basically, it's a legend. And like, the first spell you play a turn cascades. And there was some, you know, I played her.
Yeah, I think it's
Attorney Beastcrafter.
I played her and I cast a spell. And then my opponent, it was like a wrath. Like, they had to sack three creatures. I can't remember what it was. But then my opponent immediately binned creatures. I was like, no, I have effects. You know, because I wanted to put the cascade trigger on there. And a judge stopped and said, no, you missed your opportunity to do that. I said, wait a second, what? And my opponent turned to the judge and said, no, this is all my fault. I was reacting to spells. Like, well, I'm sorry, the spell's resolved and he's missed his trigger. And my opponent was just despondent. He was like, this isn't right. You know, it was my fault. I put the creatures in the graveyard before he had an opportunity to say something. As soon as I touched him, he said stop. And that was, I can't remember the gentleman's name. I was playing for fun, so I ended up beating him that round and then scooping to him because I was like, you know, that's just great. You know, you're a great person for doing that. And, you know, the second part of this question is like, what's the best non-magic thing? Like, just be nice. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how else I can say it. Like, can you just be like a polite, nice person there to have fun? Like, winning is fun. And that's part of, when I say have fun, I don't mean like, don't play to win. Play to win. Winning is fun. But, you know, you can be a nice person about it. You can be just a genuinely nice member of the community who's having a good time. And I don't know, be nice. That's kind of my outside of magic.
I mean, it sounds really simple, but like there's so many people who are not nice when you play against them, you know? I think for me, it's a little tied to streaming. I really, really love it when I get paired up against someone. This only really happens on Magic Online. Sometimes it does happen on my actual Twitch chat. I get paired against somebody who is either watching the stream or knows that I'm streaming. So they'll say like, oh, I'll hop off the stream, like, good luck. Or they say, I'll come into the stream afterward, good luck. Because what ends up happening in those spots is, and people love doing this, people in fact I think do this too much, when an opponent makes a play that's good, where it seems like, you know, and then they immediately accuse somebody of ghosting. It's ghosting, and it's like, no, they knew the cards in my hand because they duressed me. Or they're ghosting. It's like, no, it's also just the right play that you would make for sure, right? And there's a lot of people that ghost. It does happen. And I don't really want to go into that conversation, but it feels so much better when you know the person says, oh, that's cool, are you streaming right now? And it's like, yeah, I'll come and say hi later. Or, oh, I was watching the stream right now, I'm gonna shut it down, and then we get to have a good game. And then they don't have to worry about like, oh, is that play the one that tells you that they're ghosting? Because it's also not something I want to deal with, and chat's so likely to point it out when it happens. So I think that's the way you want to do it. Some people always say like, well, what if I went on the stream to see if they were streaming, but then I shut it down and then it looks like my name was signed on. And then like, well, you can just come in afterward and say like, hey, I just wanted to check if you were live. Like, it's only weird when the person's lurking and then they make a play that's like, huh, you maybe will only make that play if you know the cards, the exact card in my hand. You're playing against the rare and limited, you know?
And I want to remind everyone, I think, was that our first episode? We had a whole episode on the ghosting.
So that's a really good one. If you want to go back into our archives, I believe it was episode one, is ghosting episode one. We went deep on it. So
it was a really good one. Yeah. So if you have more, if you want more on that conversation, definitely check that out.
It was the three of us, right?
It was, yeah. I'm pretty sure it was our first episode.
I think it was our first. Yeah, if you go back to like episode number one.
It might be our second, right? Because I don't know if I was on the first episode.
First or second. It was one of the first episodes for sure.
It's an early episode. That's an early episode. Yeah.
Back in the old days of Magic FM. 3 months ago.
3 months. You know, it's been a fun 3 months. So.
Yeah, no, it really has. Oh, on that note, I want to say thank you to everybody who like dealt with us while we were figuring out our audio issues, because we recently saw people had rated, by we, I mean I. No, by we, I mean I was looking at the podcast on like iTunes, and people had rated it really highly, and I was so flattered, and I was so thankful for people to do that.
It's unbelievable. I know. Thank you. Yeah,
and awesome. Yes, thank you so much. And then part of it was people saying like, oh, Mashi's audio is not good right now, but they're working on it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, thank you for believing in us. We figured it out.
Yeah. And I want to really underscore this. Our audio issues means Mashi's audio issues, which poor patient Gabby talked and worked me through. So thank you, Gabby.
We got there. That's all that matters. I'm very happy about it.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
It really does. All right, so the next set of questions, I actually bunched them into one because they're all related to D&D, and all of them were basically directed at Luis. So, I mean, we talk about the fact that we D&D a lot. I talk about it on my stream all the time. You talk about it too. It's really fun. We obviously very much enjoy it. So General Disarray SJ asked, and this was also Justice Wright also asked the same question. Do you have any tips for a first-time D&D DM? How about tips on hosting game over Hangouts? Also for relative newcomers, thanks. And then Justice Wright's question was just like general D&D tips and advice as a DM.
So for those of you who haven't played Dungeons & Dragons, it's awesome. It's actually a Wizards property now. So, you know, if you like magic, well, Wizards makes D&D also. And I do a lot of the DM, so that I run the game, the Dungeon Master. And I think that the biggest key is really it tests your improvisational skills and you thinking on your feet. Because I think that the best campaigns and the best style, at least in my opinion, is you have the setting. You have whether you're using a campaign book or you wrote your campaign where you have like, here's the encounters and like, here's the information everyone has, or these specific characters have. Here's the monsters they'll be fighting if they come to this area, or you know, like, and you want to be able to like have a lot of preparation. Here's the items that are here. Here's the treasure, all that stuff. But one of the strengths of D&D, in fact, I think the best thing about it is it's the original sandbox game where people can do whatever they want. And I tend not to tell players you can't do that. But I also won't tell them what will happen if they do that. If someone says, well, what if I want to jump off this cliff? It's like, okay, you can do that. You're going to die, but that's up to you. You know, like in our campaign here, we're running the Tomb of Annihilation right now. Gabby's party came across a red dragon, and they wisely decided not to fight her. They could have, and she would have killed them, but they talked to her. They got some information from her. Well, then later set her up to get attacked, but they kind of set it up so some giants attacked the dragon, then they went and killed the giants. But I think that the key is you let your characters or your players do what they want to do, and you can give them hints and you can, you know, push them in a certain direction. Like if it's like, yeah, you know, they're thinking of picking a fight with someone and you're like, yeah, he looks like he's not impressed by you, or he looks very strong. Like you can say that kind of thing. But for the most part, don't feel like the story you've written or the story the campaign has written is the story that's going to be told. The story that's going to be told is what your players make of it, and that's the beauty of it. So don't make your players feel like they can't take actions or they're cut off from certain paths. And you know, I think the less on rails the better. I mean, some things, you know, there are events that trigger other events, and that's just kind of how for the story to progress to some degree that has to happen. But for the most part, I really enjoy when our, you know, the characters are basically doing what they want to do, trying to figure out what they can figure out and interacting with the people in this world. You've created the world. They're the ones who dictate kind of where things go. And you have to do your best to respond to that and kind of handle that the way that you think is best. And it takes a lot of creativity and imagination, but that's the fun part about it.
Well said. There was a little follow-up question to the D&D thing, and it was, what's your favorite class and what's also your favorite campaign book? And this was asked by Solemn Drain.
I love playing wizards, especially if you do a good job selecting spells for the campaign you're in. You'll have a lot of really good effective spells.
Are you making fun of me? Excuse me. Are you making fun of me? How dare you?
Whoa. What? I didn't.
Were you
trying
to sneak that in just to see if I didn't notice? All right. I need to add some context to this. That's so not cool, Louise. What's wrong with you? So I have played D&D. I've played three campaigns. Is this my third campaign? This is like my third or fourth campaign. And I never played a wizard before. So this time I was like, oh, I know you guys. I'm going to play a wizard. It's going to be fun. So I'm like learning how the spells work. And for wizards, it's a little different. A lot of other classes, you can like, you have a list of spells that you prepare for the day. But for wizards, you actually have to like write these into your wizard spell book. So once you choose the spell, like that's the spell you have. Right? You can ready it or not, but you don't get to go back and change your mind. So as I'm setting up this wizard, I have all these spells that are like mind control effects and like illusion effects and stuff like that. But the campaign we're playing right now deals with zombies and undead, and they don't fall for that. You can't mind control them, right? They're not alive. So every time I leveled up my character, I was like, Louise, look at all these spells that I've chosen. And I give him like five or six spells. I'm like, I need to choose one or two. Which ones are cool? And so he suggested all the spells that were like that. And I was like, yeah, these spells do look cool. So I wrote them into my spell book. And then for like so long, every time we got into a fight, my character could do nothing. Like not a single spell. And then now he's making fun of me for this because I asked him every single time, like, give me some advice. Which spell should I write into my spell book? And he's like, yeah, this one and this one and this one.
Look, the spell ended up being very good for you later. But yes, that did kind of happen.
That's not the point.
This is totally unsurprising, by the way. Can I just point that out, Gabby? You went to him for advice and he completely led you astray.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I
just want to get to the other part of the question. I think that that's probably the most germane thing to do right now.
Well, I was going to come in on your side here, Luis. I was going to say, yeah. Gabby, you can't be mad at Luis because you just have to expect that from him at this
point.
That's
true. Like, that's true.
fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice.
This is like 40 times, shame on me. Gosh.
Exactly. At this point, I feel like it's kind of your bad.
Yeah. Luis, just put it out there. In his defense, he let me go back and rewrite one of them because he knows he led me astray with one of them specifically. He let me go back and change one spell into like an actual damage spell so I could do something.
The follow-up of what's my favorite campaign, I like Temple of Elemental Evil quite a bit. It's been that's like an original campaign. It's been rewritten a bunch of times. Tomb of Annihilation, the one we're on right now, I think is also very good. So
it's been really fun so far.
Yeah.
Mashi, do you have the notes open? I want you to try to read the next question. Do you have them open or no?
Yeah, is it Synthetica?
Yeah, you got it.
At Synthetica. I looked at the notes and I was like, okay, Synthetica's asking another question.
Yeah, okay. I wanted to see if you could get it. Yeah.
I butchered it last time. Thank you so much, Synthetica. What card has the biggest gap from being nearly unplayable in one limited format to being great in a different one it appeared in?
I was trying to think of the answer to this. Nothing came off the top of my head. I saw this question earlier, but there definitely has been cards like this.
I've got one. I don't know about biggest gap. Gabby, do you have one?
It's not biggest gap. It's just better in this format and like basically unplayable in others. I was thinking of Unknown Shores is a good example.
That's a really good example. Yeah.
Yeah. Of it's like pretty decent in this format. You can actually play it as opposed to most formats. You could never even play Unknown Shores. It was just like, you know, you could add any amount of basics into your deck. Why would you do this? Yeah. What's yours, Mashi?
For me, this is a real thing. I experienced this. I think a lot of people experience this. Is in Onslaught, Glory Seeker was like a very, very good card. It's a two mana.
Yeah, that's a good example too.
One white, one other for a 2/2. When the world is full of morphs, you're getting so much value out of your 2-mana 2/2 versus everyone else's 3-mana 2/2. Well, while Onslaught was in print, they printed 7th edition. And Glory Seeker was in 7th edition. And everybody knew, like, you picked up your Glory Seekers pretty early in Onslaught draft. So then I started drafting 7th edition. I'm like, oh my God, look at all these Glory Seekers. Glory Seeker, Glory Seeker, Glory Seeker.
You're like a wielded. I can't believe it.
It was unbelievable, right? I'd have like 4 Glory Seekers in my deck. Turns out Glory Seeker in 7th edition, not great. Not very good. And so I like actually lived that experience. And I remember Sasso, Channel Fireball president and CEO, John Sasso, and I fell into this trap together because we drafted a lot of blue white in Onslaught. That was my favorite archetype. And so I was just picking up so many glory
really
seekers. And so, yeah, this happened to me. And I don't know if it's the biggest, but it's certainly the first thing that popped into my mind was the value difference in Glory Seeker.
Yeah, the other example I was thinking of for this question, because I recently played Ravnica Allegiance on Arena because I was trying to rank up to Mythic. Mistake, by the way. I should have not been playing RNA. It was not a good idea. But there's a card in that format called Sentinel's Mark. It's a 2-mana 1, like 2-mana flash plus 1, what?
So I ordered pizzas for a friend and they're having trouble finding a driver, so I need to go like coordinate this right now.
Oh, okay.
I'm just going to mute myself, but I'll continue. We can ignore that.
We can also wait for you. All right, welcome back, everybody. We are back with Synth's question of what card has the biggest gap from being nearly unplayable in one limited format to being great in a different one. So it sounds like you have an answer now, Luis.
I have kind of like Mashi's. He inspired me. It's the reverse of this, which is Shock was originally printed in Stronghold. It was excellent then because Tempest Stronghold draft was very fast. And then it was reprinted in Onslaught, and it was even better then because, again, like Mashi said, it was the Morph World.
Insane. It was so good in Onslaught.
And then it got reprinted in a core set. I think both 7th, 8th, 9th, it's been in a bunch of core sets, and it's always like just okay in core set because core sets revolves more around bigger creatures. And so the drop-off is pretty big, and you could definitely see people second-picking Shock when in reality it was not nearly as good.
That's a really good answer. Yeah, I like that one.
I think maybe the best, though, actually, is Shatter went from a mediocre sideboard card to a first pickable removal spell in Mirrodin. So
Mirrodin changed really a lot. Good. That's true. That's actually a really good point. Yeah, you would never pick a Shatter where it's like, oh, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good answer.
All right, next up we have at Cohen.
Yeah.
Who asks, what's the most memorable Magic match each of you has played?
Moshi's involved with Bathroom Acolyte, so.
Oh, actually, I wasn't even gonna go there. Oh my god, I forgot about that match.
Wait, it can't have been the most memorable one, and you forgot about it.
It's clearly Luis's most memorable because I 17'd him with a Zathrid Acolyte and killed him in an M10 draft.
Yeah,
I'm still salty. By the way, that was a team draft, and I'm still so salty because my team, you'll understand this, Gabby. My team was me. It was me, Raptor, and David Ochoa. That was my team on the team draft. Luis's team was Luis, Jerry T, and Brent, who I don't think you know Brent, but he's very, very good at Magic. Like I'm clearly like 3 or 4 steps below everybody else in this draft in terms of skill level. I run the table. I 3-0. I beat Luis. I beat Jerry. I beat Brent. Ocho and Raptor don't win a match, and we end up losing. And it's unbelievable that I would run this table.
It's Mashi pulled off like the miracle 3-0 and still lost the draft. It was incredible.
I sympathize with that a lot, Mashi. I've definitely done some team drafts where I'm like, wow, I'm the worst player here by so much. And like sometimes you run it up and you're like, wait, you were supposed to carry the team. What happened? Yeah.
I will say the match that actually came to mind was the last PTQ I ever played in years ago. I mean, this is how long ago it was. The format was Shadowmoor Block. Okay. 200 some odd players. And Sasso had set it up. We Channel Fireball. This is before Channel Fireball. This might be before Channel Fireball.
Before Channel Fireball.
Yeah. We were set up to play to vend at the PTQ. And I was there with Alex Alapin, who's also just miles and miles better at Magic than I am, like just so much better than I am. And sure enough, round one pairing, I'm playing him. And he's playing this River Kelpie dot deck, which like has like Raven's Crime and draws a bunch of cards. It's like a control deck. And I'm playing, unsurprisingly, there was a multi, it was like 3 or 4 color land destruction deck with like Ashenmoor Gouger, the Chameleon, I forgot what it's called, Chameleon Colossus. Fulminator Mage. It's just a land destruction deck. We get paired round one, and Pin, his name's Alex Alapin, we call him Pin. Pin goes, we should draw. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. This is round one of a PTQ. And he's doing. We're very close friends. He was, he was one of my groomsmen. We later lived together for 2 years. And he has so much equity on the line. Like he's a much, much better player than I am. He's played on the pro tour multiple times. To offer me the draw round one is ridiculous. And I said, no, dude, that doesn't help any of us. Let's just play. And I didn't want to say any more than that. But at the time, I was like, no matter what, he's probably going to beat me. But no matter what, I'm scooping, right? I absolutely ranch him in 2 games. I just crush him 2-0. But I didn't want to say anything. I wanted him playing seriously. So I crush him to smithereens. And then when I thought the results slip, obviously I scooped to him because there's just no – I mean, he has a chance to win it. I have a chance to
– You're just playing in it to kill some time.
Right. And so – but that is the – and to this day, I'll bring it up and be like, why don't we check the record? Online it says I won that. I'm like, So that's my most memorable match.
That's really good. Do you have yours, Luis? I have mine.
Mine is my match against Nassif in the finals of the PT.
Oh my God.
It's so memorable for me for so many reasons. I mean, speaking of launching Channel Fireball, we launched it the day before that tournament. This was our that was when we, and we weren't really even ready, but I just like had an interview.
I want to be clear here. Luis launched it and we were like, oh crap, we got to figure out how to get this website up and running.
Yeah,
and that's what we did.
We kicked it off. It was the finals of the PT. This is PT Kyoto back in 2009. And I was playing black white, kind of like mid range, like the black white weenie deck with a Bitter Blossom and a Johnny and Spectral Procession and stuff like that. And Nassif was playing 5 color control. I'm up 2-1, game 4. Just as a heartbreaker of a game where I just like was. I feel like I would have beaten almost anyone but Nassif. I think he played that game spectacularly. And it was just an incredible game. We actually, me and Marshall went back and did commentary on this game.
I don't know what it was called. This is what I was so impressed by. I knew that you hadn't seen the match in a really long time. And you remembered like turn by turn what everyone drew, what happened that turn. Like it was incredible. I've never seen anything quite like it.
Well, I remember, didn't you have like a Mind Games under the Windrush
type? I had Head Games, which is a sorcery for 3BB. It basically lets you take their hand and then replace it with, you take their hand and then you give them, search their deck and give them that many cards. So just
a bunch of crap.
Basically, if they're, you know, usually what you'll do with it is replace their hand with all lands. It was the best we had in terms of a Mind Twist at that time. And it was under Windrush Kites, which is the land where if you attack with three creatures, you can just cast the card under Windrush Kites. Oh, and the whole game, I kept trying to set up Nassif so I could get this Head Games off. And he like wasn't countering an Ajani when I had like five creatures in play because he was so worried the card under Windrush Kites was exactly Head Games. And it was. And but I managed to like land it much later, but at that point
it was too late.
Well, it wasn't too late. Well, I actually was still winning by a lot. Nassif then peeled his way out of it. He peeled like Muldrifter into like just
he hit runner.
It was like it was such a heartbreaking game where I just felt like I was like winning so much, but I couldn't quite close it. And he kept like wriggling his way out of it. It was just an insane game. I would recommend you go back and watch the rewatch. You can also see how far our cameras have come in.
Yeah,
in 10
they,
years.
They look so grainy. It's like, you know, like 320p at most.
Yeah, but that game is kind of like seared into my memory, and I have a pretty good memory for Magic games in general. I remember a lot of my old matches, but that one in particular was by far the most memorable.
You know what I can do? I can find that match of you and Marshall going over it on the like Rewind
YouTube,
channel. Yeah, and I can link it in the show notes, so if you want to go see it, I've seen this match before. It's really incredible. If you want to go ahead and see it with like, you know, post commentary, that this is a cool thing you can check out for sure.
It's still too fresh for me. 11 years.
Too soon.
All the guys back in California, like, you know, Mashi and John and Penn and, you know, all the folks who are involved in launching Channel Fireball were watching this live at like 3 a.m.
Oh my gosh!
It was.
I could not take that.
Together.
Oh, that sounds so painful to watch. I knew how it ended, and I was watching the match, and I was like, oh god.
Just the drama of it, because like, oh my god, he's gonna win, because on board you were gonna win that match, and he played perfectly. Nassif is a master, and he drew so well. Like the whole time I was like, he's gonna win, he's got it, he's gonna win, and it's just, there was nothing you could do. You were playing perfectly too, and it's like you could just watch it slowly slip away.
Oh man,
and then
it's like watching an accident.
The door slammed shut on that cruel ultimatum, and it was just like
you know, and it's all circled back 11 years later, where Nassif beat me in the MPL and Worlds race this year. So I was I was fifth, and he was
You're
fourth.
Right.
is he your nemesis?
He's not my nemesis. I love Nassif, and like we've actually played a bunch of times, and it's not like it's too one-sided, but he's definitely come on the better end of the exchange in terms of like he's gotten there slightly ahead of me in some pretty high leverage spots.
Yeah, he is a wonderful person, obviously.
Oh, of course.
Nassif. And you'd be so lucky to have Gabriel Nassif as your nemesis, by the way.
Yeah, that's true. Anyone I was going to say, you'd be lucky to have
that. I don't want to go rewatch that match now.
Yeah, I have to find it, Luis, for the show notes. I can link it to you. When
I won't do it during the podcast, though, because
Luis, I'm watching you. Stop.
this is not LR.
This is one of those other podcasts I do.
All right, Gabby, hit us.
So I have two. I'll tell you a bridge version of both. They're honestly so spectacular, both of them, that I couldn't pick between the two. One of them was actually with Luis. He was a guest on my stream. I think this was like 2 years ago. And if you know Luis and you know how he cubes, you know he loves drafting no win condition Storm, right? And I am not the biggest Storm fan. I don't really draft it when he's not around. But when he comes on my stream, I'm like, okay, let's do it. Let's draft the Storm deck, right? So people are freaking out during the draft because we don't have a win condition. And honestly, I do think that happens too often. Like people, not even just in Storm, just in general, people are always freaking out because you don't have a finisher. And it's like, no, you're a red-black control deck. Like you can kill them with anything once you like stabilize, right? Or like a blue-white control deck, you really don't need that much to actually kill.
Well,
anyway,
Celestial Colonnade, that's my finisher.
Yes, you know? Exactly. Like you can kill them with Celestial Colonnade. You don't need any win conditions, right? So anyway, we're doing this Storm draft. And we really actually go through the entirety of it. And we're like towards the third pack, like the beginning / middle end of it. We're now really actively looking for a way to kill, but we don't get there. It's a disaster of a draft, right? So I'm like, Luis, we can't play this deck. We can't win. He's like, wait a second. He's like doing the like big brain calculations, like math on the walls, you know, like that gif. He's like, we have a Siege Gang Commander and a Corpse Dance. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, what does that do for us? He's like,
corpse dance is awesome.
He's like, this is a win condition. We totally can do it. We just have to now splash red. But this deck can generate infinite mana. It is a storm deck. It can do that because we had Palancron. So I'm like, this is horrible. I can't believe we're going to do this. So we go into the first match, right? We go into the thing where we start trying to storm off, but it's like basically impossible to do it. We get into this point where we have like High Tide going and I have a Palancron in hand. And I don't have that many lands, so all we're netting is like one mana per turn. But basically the spot we got into was if I looped Palancron like 40 times or something, which took so long. If I do all of that, what I can do then is play Siege Gang Commander, sack it to itself, play Corpse Dance, getting it back with buyback to get another Siege Gang Commander to sack it to itself. Yeah. And you can keep doing that. The whole thing.
It's only 7 mana for 2 damage. It's a good deal.
Yeah, it's 7 mana.
You only have to generate 2 damage. Mana.
And I think my opponent was over 20 for some reason. And we did the whole thing.
You can sacrifice the tokens too, though, right?
Yes, you can.
Siege Gang gives you, so you're getting more than two, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you do end up getting a better rate. Yeah, you eventually can start attacking the one ones. But it was incredible because this deck looked like it could never win ever. And I think we like 2-1 with the deck or something. It was amazing.
I would be so annoyed playing you. I would be so...
I could not believe the poor opponents that we subjected to like looping Palancron 40-something times. And
so we had a good strategy. We would make a bunch of mana with Palancron, but not all of it. And then use the Siege Day and Corpse Dance thing and had a couple people just concede on like the second loop of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Once they realized, writing's on the wall.
Here. Some people did like let us do the whole thing though. So like, you know, running out of time was a real consideration. It was so funny. See if I can.
Those are misers.
Too.
They're trying to mise your time out whenever they make you do your combo on Modo. It's like, I know you got it, but let's see if you can do it in time.
To be fair though, if I played against somebody who's playing Corpse Dance and the Siege Gang Commander as their win condition, I'd let them like play it out. It seems so unreasonable as a win condition.
Corpse Dance is so sweet. It's one of my favorite cube cards.
Yeah, Corpse Dance is really cool. The other game that's so funny, it was back when I was like really into playing Tron, which I haven't really played in a long time. As you guys know, I like always time out on Magic Online. This is just like a thing I routinely do. So I was playing a game of Tron and we got into the spot where...
Oh my God, I know this game.
Got into the spot where my opponent, I forget what was it. It's one of those cards that you just go through the entire deck and take all of them out and it exiles them permanently. So I ran out of ways to kill them. Like I could not actually kill them. So the only thing I could do is restart the game with Karn to try to kill them again. So I do that and we restart the game. So now we're in the second game. And obviously I'm like way lower on time as this is going on. And I finally get into a point where I can kill them. And I have to do is Karn to take down or something, but I have like a minute and a half left on the clock. So I'm like, I'm going super fast and going through the motions to try to actually kill them. And I accidentally, my Karn's at such a high loyalty that the option to restart the game is an option at the moment. So I click it to try to exile one of their permanents and I accidentally restart the game again with a minute and a half left on the clock.
Oh my God.
So I'm just like, oh my God. So now I have a minute and a half to try to kill, to win this game. And I just had the nuts, like Tron Keep. I didn't even look at it. I just immediately kept because I had so little time. But I actually had like turn 3 Tron with like turn 4 Ugin. And this is back when Emrakul was a thing. So I could Emrakul and actually killed them with like 3 seconds left on the clock.
It was amazing.
It was so good.
Oh my God.
It was incredible. So yeah, it was the accidental restart.
This is unbelievable. And I just want to say, this is such a sign of the times, right? Like, Luis and I have our most memorable matches or live Magic gameplay. And you had two, Gabby, but both of them were digital.
Both of them are on stream. Online. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all great, but it's really interesting. It's really a sign of the times. I mean, Luis and I are dinosaurs, obviously, but it's interesting to see that, you know, it's just an observation.
Hello, fellow kids.
How do you do, fellow Magic players?
Ooh.
This one is for Mashi. Red David Wright asks, what would Pillage have... Rev David Wright. Yeah, you're totally right. What would Pillage have to cost to be viable in Vintage Cube? My personal estimation is RR.
I don't play enough Vintage Cube to know for sure. My gut would be one red, one other, as opposed to a double red commitment. because then it's just at worst, it's a sorcery speed shatter. But I mean, my heart wants to say one red, let's go. But one red, one other, I think is probably where you need to be in a cube that's that powered. What do you guys think?
I think at red, it would actually be really good still.
Okay.
I think if you're mono red, you would want that card.
Oh, like, it'd be insane in mono red. I think it'd be too much at one and a red. Because at one and a red, any deck would just play it. And because destroy target artifact is already pretty good in vintage cube, and destroy target land is insane for one and a red. Yeah. I think at red, you could put it in the cube and force people who want to play this card to mean it. You know, at one red, it's not playable.
Yeah, I would be worried if it was colorless and red, it would just be like too many decks would want to mize into playing it, and that seems like you don't want that. But that seems like a really good tool for mono red if you just put it at red, and then because there's so many lands that are so scary in vintage cube, being able to like nug those or color screw your opponent is actually pretty meaningful.
Would one red, one other sorcery speed shatter be playable in vintage cube if it didn't have the land component? Just, I don't
wait. One red, one other sorcery speed shatter. Like no, that wouldn't be good enough. No.
Okay, because that's why I was wondering about the red.
Well,
right?
the land component's so
huge.
Yeah.
That's just lets you time walk your opponent, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, let's just be honest. At 2 red, 1, I'm probably still drafting Pillage.
Much really... as like it doesn't matter what it costs, I'm going to be drafting it anyway.
I'm like, ooh, first pick Pillage. Let's go. So, all right. I love the idea though. Thank you for the question. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a good Mashi question for sure.
All right, at AdamP88 asks, how did you know you were really hooked on Magic for the long haul? I think it's a good one for you to kick us off on, Gabby. How did you know?
It was more like when I was way past the point. So so I'm a gamer, right? I've been playing games all my life. When I was a kid, my sister would give me an unplugged controller and told me to like smash harder or we're not gonna be Bowser, you know? So like that was kind of my upgrade bringing, and a lot of the ways that I interacted with my sister were through playing games. So I've always loved playing games, tabletop, video games, strategy card games, etc. I knew that I was on the long haul for Magic when it had been the long haul, basically.
Yeah.
Because there's so many games that I have played throughout the years and I love them, especially like game series. Like I've played a ton of the Final Fantasy games. I've played like all the Harvest Moon simulator style games. You know, I've played all the Smash Brothers. I've played all the Mario Kart games. Whenever they're out, I'll play them for a bit until like you kind of get, you're done with it. And then you wait until the next release, you know, all the Mario Party games, stuff like that. All the Legend of Zelda games, I've played literally all of them. But Magic, I just continuously kept playing. Like there was no point at which I really stopped. There was a period where I was doing yoga teacher training and I wasn't playing as much. But I was like still really good friends with everybody who played Magic, and
That's true for most Magic players.
Yeah, I think everybody goes through a period where you take off for a little bit, and then I meant
they take a break to do yoga teacher training.
Yeah, everyone on this podcast has, right?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, man. Obviously.
You got me good.
It's like, but yeah, humble. It was. Yeah, there was that time when I was studying to be a yoga instructor, you know. But other than that, it's been pretty solid.
So that was it for me. I basically never really stopped. And at some point I was like, huh, I've been playing this game for a really long time now. I guess I'm just going to keep doing that. And I've never really stopped since then. How about you guys?
For me, it was probably, you know, a year after I started playing when like I would be in school writing deck lists in the margins of my notebook and like,
oh my gosh,
counting the days until I could go to the local store, which I got to go to like every Thursday. And then on the weekends, like they had like a Thursday night tournament. And then on the weekends I would go as well. And then I would soon realize that I would talk about Magic with my friends. And that's what we would talk about. Like it did not take long for Magic to like, you know, get its tendrils wrapped around me.
Yeah. I was in a similar situation to Luis. I remember my sophomore or junior year of high school. My buddy Graham and I, our chemistry teacher just didn't care about anything. We would just sit in the back in the labs and just play Magic. And like my whole life revolved around the new decks I was going to build to play Magic that week in chemistry. And then like, I'd crash at his place because he and his brother and I all played together. And we'd be playing Magic till like 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. And it was just awesome. And that continued on for a long time. I took a quick break in college. And then when I got into college, I started playing like competitively. This is just kitchen table stuff. And that was just like on, you know, Monday and Tuesday were like different deck list ideas scribbled everywhere. Wednesday was when I started playtesting for FNM. I mean, it was just like my whole life. My girlfriend at the time did not approve. So yeah, that I was hooked for sure.
Yeah. Strandjack asks, what's your favorite non-magic game to play?
For me, like D&D probably is my second favorite game. Just it's brought me like some pretty lifelong connections. It's actually really funny that a lot of my friends in high school, like not necessarily who went to the same high school, but friends during that time, we kind of met through Magic, like at the local store or what have you. And then we started playing D&D together. And now, you know, many, many years later, I still see those guys when I go back to California, they still play D&D, you know, and like this is, it's turned into a D&D kind of friend group. Instead of Magic, none of them play Magic anymore. Like, I'm the only one who plays Magic. But they all, like, still like getting together to play D&D or other games or other board games. And D&D has been really enduring. You know, it's something that has provided a pretty strong backdrop, even though Magic is certainly, like, the primary game. As for right now, though, Slay the Spire has kind of got me hooked. I've been slaying the Spire quite often.
What about you, Mosh?
So it's tough. I don't play a lot of games. I would say, I don't think this is in the spirit of the question, but I haven't played in years, but I used to play every week. I used to love playing volleyball.
That's a game. Volleyball. That's not a magic game. It totally counts.
When I was living in LA, I would drive down, there's just a group of, you know, guys that I would play on the beaches in Santa Monica with. And I'm terrible. I'm awful. Awful at volleyball, but I love it, especially on the sand, because you can dive around and jump around and really hustle, and that's how I pulled each of my hamstrings, and that's kind of when I stopped playing volleyball, because now it's hard to slow down. In terms of like board games or non-magic games, I loved the first Diablo, and then when I got a Switch, I bought Diablo 3 and I played just grinded infinite Diablo. Nice. So that's probably my favorite video game, and it actually makes me hopeful for the new Magic game, because at Strandjack is our very own Dennis Strandjack, and when he was at PAX, he demoed the new Magic game. And I was like, "What's it like?" He's like, "Just like Magic, but he said it was really good."
That's good.
He's like, "It's basically like Magic, but Diablo. You're playing Diablo, but with the Magic IP." And I was like, "Oh God, I'm so in!
I played an infinite Diablo and Diablo 2, though. By the time Diablo 3 came out many years later, I was not in the market for that experience.
Yeah.
How about you, Gabby?
This one's hard for me because I play so many games.
Gabby's the most true gamer of all of us, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think it's less that there's a number two category for me, and there's definitely more games that I like go through a kick. Like I get a kick for it, and then I just jam those games. So I would say the like three latest ones that I felt that with were probably Slay the Spire, which I've been playing a ton. Hearthstone Battlegrounds, which I played so much. When we were in Hawaii, that's like we were just jamming it at the beach. And Stardew Valley is another game that I've just poured so many hundreds of hours into, like all the simulator games.
I love watching you play Stardew Valley.
It's really fun.
It's really fun.
I want to stop this for a second. You're on the beaches of Hawaii playing a digital game?
Yes, we were.
We were on the beach, though.
We were on
this
the beach,
okay.
But we were no, on the this phone.
Is not okay.
What do you mean the phone? Okay.
I'm sorry. It's not okay.
It's the same as someone reading a book and get it while
it's not that
on the
different
beach.
From reading a book at the beach, yeah.
No,
it was so good, is, Mosh. We set up a tent. We like rented the tents and the canopy
like
and stuff.
We would go in the water.
We brought all the food.
Then, yeah,
we would go in the water and then come back.
How is this not the thing that you're talking about?
I just for some reason, reading a book sounds appropriate and great. Like you needed that environment to really enjoy the book, to relax.
Mosh, I can't believe that we'd be that obsessed with Hearthstone Battlegrounds while we were in Hawaii.
I mean, trust me, I can. You don't know my brother Tommy right now, literally, it's 11:22. He could be on his second game because he slept. He stayed up all night playing. Like all he
and
does
now
is
he's
Battlegrounds.
Just still playing.
You know how I know that? Whenever I streamed Battlegrounds, which I did probably three or four times, Tommy would always be on the stream.
That's sweet.
And it was really funny because like, he's better at Battlegrounds than I am. So when he would make suggestions in chat, I would always just follow them.
That's right.
He's like very good. He does a lot of co-ops. And he's like pseudo coaching people in Battlegrounds.
That's
it's
so sweet.
Funny.
No, yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah.
No, I obviously I love Tommy. Like we worked together for many years. So, you know,
yeah.
Big fan.
But that's awesome.
It's not. It'd be like this. If T and I were in Hawaii on the beach and he was trying to play Battlegrounds, I'd slap that thing right out of his hand.
That's just being that you're just being like elitist here. If a book is fine, how is Battlegrounds not?
I don't know. I'm struggling with that.
I understand something not feeling right. Like I understand. I can understand.
Right, like Mashi's argument.
My argument is flawless.
It's falling apart. It's like Swiss cheese, Mosh.
So, oh my gosh. At Neodim231 asks us, what's a card that probably should have never been printed, but you are still glad it exists? Oof.
For me, it might be Brainstorm in the, well, I don't know. So Brainstorm is too good by almost any metric in all the formats it's legal in. I guess it's restricted in Vintage, legal in Legacy, and nowhere else. But when it got printed, it wasn't that good. And it took a while. It basically took until Fetchlands came out, which were, I don't know, 6 or 7 years later, that really where it popped off. So maybe Brainstorm's fine. It's brought a lot of people joy over the years. I kind of feel like, I don't know. I guess for me personally, it might be like all the Eldrazi in Rise of the Eldrazi, or sorry, in Battle for Zendikar and Oath of the Gatewatch.
BFD.
Because that got me, like, our team just broke it for that PT, and that's something I really treasure. Like, I got to give credit to like the face to face team guys. They really came up with this deck where it combined Eye of Ugin and Eldrazi Temple with Thought Not Seer and Reality Smasher, all the new Eldrazi, and that deck was just absurd. And, you know, there's 5 Eldrazi decks in the top 8 and all that. So that, I think, was probably net negative for Eldrazi Temple and Eye of Ugin to interact that way with Eldrazi. But I sure loved it.
How about you, Gabby? Do you have a favorite card like that?
Probably all the Tron lands. They're clearly so stupid. Like, it should just not really be a deck. But I've just gotten so much enjoyment and love out of playing with the Tron lands. I don't really play Tron that much anymore. But I, like, Lifetime have played so much of it. And it brought me great joy. Let's just put it that way.
Tron's great, though. I think Tron's okay.
You think so? I mean, it's been weird because I've gone through, like, I started playing Tron when it was terrible, and then it went through a phase where it was excellent. And so then it became kind of the boogeyman, and people hated it. And it was so weird for me to see because I was like, wait, this Tron deck, the one that was really bad and like couldn't ever win?
The thing is, Tron's never had to be banned. I mean, yeah, some parts about Tron can be annoying, and I understand.
Yeah,
the
but
people
some people hate Tron. Like, they hate it.
I still think it's overall positive that Tron exists and is something that people can play.
Yeah, I mean, I love it, obviously.
For me, like, I talk about land destruction a lot, but I also love, like, bringing creatures back from the graveyard and bringing resources back from the graveyard. And part of that is because, you know, back in the old days, that was a rare thing. Like, you had cards like Resurrection, you know, which was ironically a white spell. You have Animate Dead, you know, and you know, in those days it was like, oh, I'm just going to not play land this turn, discard my Lord of the Pit and then Animate Dead. Of course, that's stupid because you have sac creatures, but you know, something yeah. like that. Or you discard your Nether Shadow, whatever. And I love graveyard recursion stuff. Like, we were talking about Corpse Dance earlier. And one of the spells I loved forever when it was in type 2 was Yawgmoth's Will. And Yawgmoth's Will is a great card. It's a lot of fun. That card never should have been printed. It's way too good, especially in a set. I mean, they printed that in a set with Dark Ritual
and Lotus Petal. Well, Lotus Petal was well, that's before, not, but Lotus Petal was legal. Yeah.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. But being able to a ritual, like ritual, Yawgmoth's Will, ritual.
That's really funny.
And Bargain, you know, Bargain was in that block. But yeah, I love Yawgmoth's Will. It's one of my favorite cards that was ever printed. I love the art on it. I just love everything about Yawgmoth's Will. And I don't think it should ever been printed. It's way too OP.
I've cast a lot of Yawgmoth's and I love it, but yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. So that's definitely the card
that's
for
me. That's a really good answer for sure. Yuri C. Anhos asks, maybe everyone already knows this, but I might have missed the video/podcast where you talk about it. Do you all, Gabby, LSV, Matt, and Julie live in the same house? And Julie. If you do or did, who cooks or who would cook? So I figured we should address this because I get this on my stream all the time. People will see the dog and they'll say like, oh, it's the bandwagon dog. And it's like, yeah, it's also my dog. So I figured we could just clarify that real quick. So Luis and Julia and I live in the same house, and Matt Nass lives in Denver. So whenever we record the bandwagon, he comes over.
Oh, yeah, not these days.
What'd you say?
Not these days.
Not these days. In fact,
the bandwagon has been banned.
We are working on a virtual bandwagon, so we can. Yeah. So that's in the works. I'm looking into this right now, but. We will be bringing you some maybe less Julie cameos if we do that, and she's not going to be able to be on the camera, but we'll figure that out. Anyway, just wanted to clarify that one. I thought that was a pretty funny question.
Yeah, it was very good.
Train MTG asks, do you guys play EDH? And if you do, what commanders do you play? If not, what deck do you want to play, and who do you want at the helm?
I don't play EDH. I don't know about you guys. I've played exactly one game of Commander. I borrowed a deck from Krim, the Asian Avenger.
The Asian Avenger.
Who's awesome. Shout out to Krim. We'll talk about, he's a lot of fun. He used to work here. I love Krim. Not playing EDH, I will say two things. I think my sense of it is that there isn't really a good place for land destruction. And just for the record, I get that Armageddon is a spell that destroys all lands. That's not really kind of in the vein of what a land destruction, an LD player wants. I want to destroy your lands, not necessarily mine. So I don't think there's a good LD commander, but like I just said with the Yawgmoth's Will stuff, I would want a commander that allowed me to really interact, like something that was almost like a Rexxur type commander, right? Where maybe I'm searching my deck, I'm being able to reanimate or bring stuff back from my graveyard, a lot of 187 creatures to get that extra value. That's the kind of thing I think I'd want out of an EDH deck. But I don't know how viable that is. Maybe there's a million commanders that do that. And Yamash, that's like the second most popular archetype. Or dude, that's a horrible strategy. It never works. No idea.
What about you, Luis?
So I did have a commander deck for quite a while. It was Dralnu Lich Lord. It was like a blue-black deck with a bunch of counter spells and card draw. And
yeah, I remember
Dralnu
that, yeah.
To like to kind of put the nail in the coffin. It was pretty fun, but I haven't played it in quite a bit.
I think I may have played more Commander than both of you. I used to actually go to my local shop and play Commander. And this is back when BK... This is when BK and I were like kind of first getting into Magic. So the Commander decks that we had were really just like, what cards do we own? We'll put whatever card we have in it, you know? In the real spirit of like tabletop Magic, you know? And so I used to play a lot more. Eventually, I kind of liked playing 1v1 just a little bit better. So I don't play as much Commander anymore. The commanders that I love are honestly like the value commanders. So I love the like Roshni, Eternity's Crafters, like the ones that cascade, the Yarok, the Desecrated kind of. I don't know. I love the like value commanders. I think they're super fun. I played Roshni, Eternity's Crafter in an episode of Game Nights that we did with Jimmy and Josh, which was really fun. And I don't actually have a commander deck on me right now, but I've actually been wanting to make a new one. So I've been on the lookout for it. I will say that I had a super cool Yarok, the Desecrated deck that my friend Sunnyvale made for me for Brawl. And this is back when Oko was in the format. So I was like, oh, here comes my Yarok. And they're like, okay, here's a 3-3. And I'm like, I guess I won't play Brawl anymore. It was really sad.
I will say that when I was first getting back into Magic, because I kind of stopped playing during high school, me and my friends would play. This was kind of before Commander, actually. We just had like 1 to 200 card decks full of cards we liked, and we would just play that over and over again. That was the format, as it were. So I think if Commander had existed at that time, I would have probably played Commander then. That would have been the period of time
that makes sense.
That I would have spent playing Commander. But then once I started getting more competitive, it's like I like a lot of goofy formats, but one of the things that's really important to me is that it's one-on-one. I just remembered this. Me and my roommate in college, Eirik, we played in there was a Commander tournament in Davis and we played in the finals of it.
That's really cool.
It was a 1v1 Commander tournament, and it was a lot of fun. Yeah. Who's my commander? I played Dralnu in that, and he played a Horde of Notions so we could get all five colors. That was pretty sweet. Yeah.
Shout out to Eirik Aune, actually. I haven't seen Eirik in a long time. I never thought of it, Luis, but I think I agree with you. You're quite right. Like if I had discovered Commander earlier on in my Magic playing days, I'd be far more into it, because you know, I joke about this, but this is the reality of it. For a long time, when I started playing Magic, I would open a pack or whatever cards I had, and the red card went in my red deck, the black card went in my black deck, the white card went in my and that's like, I had these huge decks, right?
That's how my commander deck was. It was literally like, oh, this is a black card, I opened my draft, it's going in the commander deck, I guess. You know, it didn't even matter if it had no synergy. Like, it was just literally the cards I owned.
So I could definitely see that. I think it's a great point. So
the other thing that was cool about that time, that period of time when I was really into Commander, is this is when my knowledge of Magic cards was much lower. So I didn't know about cards that could be cool in my deck. So I remember taking my trade binder into the store and looking at other people's trade binders and finding cards that I thought were so sweet in my Commander deck. It was like, oh my gosh, Bone Horde is perfect because I have XYZ. It's not a card I even knew existed, but I would trade for those cards because I was trading for my Commander deck. It was really cool.
That's insane.
Yeah. And this is our...
Commander's come a long way.
Yeah, it really has. So this is our last question for today. Gibson Cat 9 asks, what's the deck you remember playing competitively with the highest fun to play versus power level disparity? As in, you probably should have just picked a better deck, but you liked it so much you couldn't resist.
I almost did this at the last PT, actually. I really liked playing blue-white control. I played it a ton before the PT.
Oh, that's right.
All I was doing was streaming blue-white. I got a bunch of league trophies with it, and I really wanted to play it, but my team convinced me it was just a bad idea. And I'm glad I played the Lotus Breach deck because I ended up doing pretty well. I went 8-2 with it, but I came very close to wanting to just go with blue-white control there.
That first draft pod killed me, Luis.
Yeah, me too.
Phoenix. I mean it.
My deck was so good. Oh man, did not get that.
I am discovering as we talk about Kyoto, the Kyoto finish, and now your performance in Phoenix. I'm far too emotionally tied to your performance in these two years. It like tightens my chest. I'm like,
it's always rough for me watching QE play for top eight or watching, you know, Eirik in the finals of a PTQ. It's hard for me to watch because I just want them to win so much, even more than like myself. And, you know, I have no control. I just have to sit there and watch. So I often will not watch as a result.
Yeah. It can be more stressful to watch other people's matches, right? Because you just can't do anything about them and you want it so much to be.
And it is torture. Like the real torture, you know, we talked about you and Nassif being neck and neck is, you know, you guys are both great. I consider both of you friends. You guys, you know, it's just hard. You never want to root. You're so used to just at the start of a tournament, you root for all your friends. And there's that
rooting against players feels bad.
It's
for sure.
And it's the, at least in the world of Gabriel Nassif versus LSV, you know, I'm always on your side, Luis. No offense, Nassif. I love that. But it's also just like, at least I know a great player and a great person's going to win no matter what. And you always have that kind of consolation. Like once he's sewn it up, like I'm so pro hat right now. I want him to just take everything down. So how about you, Gabby?
I've been thinking about it. I think it might be the Grishol brand, the old Grishol brand deck.
That was good.
Magic Online. It's a deck that is so fragile. It's just complete glass cannon. And it's so easy to kill yourself with it. And it's not especially good. But I just loved playing. Something about the deck was just so much fun for me. And it was really funny to watch because it's one of those decks where you draw your entire deck and like that's how you try to figure out a kill. And it involves you finding like Simeon Spirit Guides and Metamorphoses and like... You can get in situations where if you don't have certain cards in your deck, it's like impossible for you to win. So I would play this on stream and I played it in a bunch of events. And chat has some really bad lines with this. Like it's very, very hard for, I think, chat to suggest a real lines of play for this deck because you just have so many cards and like people don't know what the card does or don't even know if you have it in your hand. And I just played so much of this deck, even though all that happened.
You want the real experience? Play Doomsday.
Oh my gosh, no!
Playing Doomsday on stream is so good. Chat's just suggesting piles without win conditions, 6-card piles.
Yeah, like piles that aren't five cards.
Including cards that aren't in your deck.
Cards that aren't. Doomsday. Yes, I was gonna say cards that are not in your deck. It's just.
It's a very hard. That's a very hard card to play. Period. Doomsday. Yep. Like you are.
One of my favorite stream memories was I was playing Doomsday on stream and Matt Nass came over. And I'm like, oh, here, Matt, take over real quick. I got to go do something. And he sits down and he's like, there's a Doomsday deck here. He's never played it. It's vintage. He hasn't really played vintage. And I'm like, all right. And then chat's just going off. But Matt, of course, Matt Nass is a very good combo player. So he figured out how to do it. But it is funny because I was just like throwing him in the deep end.
Yeah.
Let's see. So this is going to have to be a throwback because I haven't played competitive Magic in a long time. It's kind of a tie. For a long time during when Fires was in Standard, I said Standard. When Fires was in Standard, I played Skies. And I played Skies because Skies was a mono blue flyer deck, and it ran Rising Waters, which is like Winter Orb, which actually I don't even know if that's a great reference. But you know, Rising Waters locks down your opponent's lands. You can untap one land a turn. And Skies kind of played like Sly, like mono red Sly, where because you had a one drop, you had Cloud Sprite into Riftskate into Rishadan Airship. But you had a one drop, two drop, three drop. So you could get an aggro start, then you back up with cards like Thwart and Foil and stuff like that. It was not a great choice for the metagame because your only answer to a deck like Fires was cards like Submerge, which is a great card, but it's not that great against Blastoderm, which you can't target. and so you really, you know, it was like an aggro deck that wasn't the most aggressive deck in the format because, you know, Burst could own you and stuff like that. I love that deck. I played a lot of that deck because, like I said, it played kind of like
something about deck. Destroying people's lands really just does it for Mashi.
Yeah.
This is more prison. Like, you get that Rishadan Port Rising Waters lock. It was good. Yeah. But I think. So I really should have chosen a better deck in that format, but I was very comfortable. I also got to a point where I was very comfortable with that deck. But it's funny for me to say there was a rogue deck I loved. I built it, so obviously I had my own love for it. And I actually, the best I ever did in a competitive tournament was with this deck, but there were way better choices that I should have been playing. And it was like, it was in a similar format where Fires was still huge, but there was another deck called Turbo Obliterate where you played a bunch of sac lands and obliterated the board over and over. And you won with like Nether Spirit, and then there was like a Caustic Tar was a win condition. I know these are cards that no one's ever heard of, but I had a deck that was like Meddling Mage, and I loved Parallax Wave. And Parallax Wave was a way you could survive Obliterate, right? Because Obliterate didn't hit enchantments, and you'd wave out your creatures, you'd obliterate, the obliterate in response to Obliterate. Then you know the wave would go out, you get all your creatures back, and you'd have a board. And you could combine it with cards like Defender and Vec, which could block Blastoderm because it could heal itself. Waving out your Meddling Mage gave you more opportunities to block other cards. I played Blinding Angel, which was a way to lock your opponents down if they were playing aggro. So I realized none of these cards are immediately available to anyone listening to this podcast. But that was a deck that I built that was very good, I think, for one tournament. And I got very lucky because I played against a lot of Turbo Obliterate. And the deck was designed to play against Turbo Obliterate. I played Geddon's because Geddon was like a death knell to Obliterate and stuff like that. So I really probably should have played Turbo Obliterate in that format because it was clearly the best deck, but that's my answer. So my two answers, I should say. Wow. Okay. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I think mailbag shows are fun because we should focus more on the non-magic questions. It's always fun to just hang out and talk about magic and not magic. So yeah. It's been a good week. I guess now that you're home all the time, maybe you're gonna be on more Magic FMs. We'll see. But we'll see. That's gonna do it for this week. She is Gabby Spartz at Gabby Spartz across all social media platforms. He is Luis Scott Vargas at LSV across all social media platforms. I am Mashi Scanlon, the guy on the left at Mashi Scanlon across
there
all
we
social
go. Media.
And that does it for us this week. Thanks for submitting all your wonderful questions. Thanks for sticking with us during this podcast. We will talk to you next week. In the meantime, be wonderful to yourself and be wonderful to each other. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.